I agree with you, Nick. I think a lot has to do with the teachers and the school and the kind of the mission and the learning principles and the values. Those are all really important. The IB is a vehicle, but really at the end of the day, it's about the teacher that's in the room. And what are they doing to engage you and motivate you and really get you excited about learning? And I think that's what's important. The AP and IB are different curriculums, but I think it's really the teachers. And I think it's so important when you look at a school is also think about the teachers, the mission, what are the principles, what are the values that the school is, engaging with. And I think those are so important. I think we were talking off air about the tier one, tier two, tier three. I think that's a bit of a dangerous thing to do. Just because you don't have a lot of money and you have a big flagship school doesn't mean you can have incredible teachers delivering really rigorous curriculum. So I'm always hesitant to classify schools. I think it's about what they stand for, how consistent, and how do they, what is their pedagogic compass, and how well do they stick to it, and how well do they make it consistent through the school. I think that.
Welcome to episode 75 of Tokyo Alumni Podcast. Our guest today is a binational Swiss American born and raised in Switzerland with an American father and Swiss mother, and was educated in Switzerland, England, and the United States of America. He's a trainer and a course designer at the Principal Training Center and the Teacher Training Center. He is also a learning to community coach and trainer at the Ministry of Education of Luxembourg. He has 25 years of experience working in education and media technology and 17 years as a leadership team member in international schools around the world, including schools in Tanzania, China, Czech Republic, Switzerland, Luxembourg, and Japan at ASIJ, which is actually where our paths crossed 21 years ago when he joined ASIJ in 2000, and he stayed there until 2005. And I was there as a student from 2000 till 2005 as well. I've shared his homepage below in the little detail part for various web pages he hosts. And he is also the co-host of a podcast focused on international education titled The International School Podcast. Currently, he is the head of education and media technology deputy principal at the International School of Luxembourg. Thank you for joining us today, John.
Thank you, Nick. It's wonderful to be on your podcast and for us to reconnect like this. Just what a pleasure, really a real treat, and looking forward to the conversation.
So obviously you have quite the versatile and illustrious education background. As I mentioned in the bio, Tanzania, Luxembourg, Czech Republic, but this is the Tokyo Alumni Podcast. So I do really want to start with that focus with Japan. You have a very unique sort of connection to Japan. That dates all the way back to 1988 when you first lived in Japan, through the JET program. So I wanted to ask you, obviously 12 years later, you ended up back in Japan through ASIJ, but was there ever sort of growing up an affinity or like an interest that you had in Japan that took you there in the first place?
None whatsoever. I will be honest, having grown up in Switzerland, we were more, and having an American father, everything was more American-centric or Europe. I had no connections with Asia whatsoever. But when I moved, after I graduated from undergraduate school, I worked in the business world and worked for a newspaper in San Francisco, the San Francisco Bay Guardian. And that was really my first exposure to the Asian culture. And I absolutely fell in love with it. San Francisco has a vibrant Japantown. There's a big Korean community. And in my work, I was in advertising sales. I had many interactions with different Asian businesses and people in advertising. And in just the newspaper industry was very multicultural. And that's where I really culture. And it really just resonated with me. I mean, of course, the food was the first place. And San Francisco being a very rich Asian community, as they say, if you live in San Francisco, you're always interacting with multicultures. So that's where really kind of I made this connection. And then I was working in the business world, and I was a little concerned looking at the people that were maybe 10 years ahead of me that were stressed out and balding and having heart attacks. I was like, wow, maybe I should go for an adventure. And I thought I would love to go to Asia. And I thought, well, I could go backpacking, but maybe I could get a job and, you know, earn some money and also get to travel a bit in Asia. And I was running an ad for the Japanese embassy in our newspaper for the JET program. So I thought, well, let me talk. And I talked to the person in charge, and then I applied, had an interview, and we were the first class. I think we were the first ones or second ones. And we all ended up at the in Shinjuku at the Keio Plaza Hotel. And we were greeted by the mayor of Tokyo. And it was just, you know, it was just unbelievable. If you don't know or have experienced Japanese hospitality, it just seems unbelievable. It's so generous, it's opulent, it's kind. It's just so graceful. And so, of course, I just got completely won over. And then I got shipped out to Chichibu, which is up in Saitama-ken. And Chichibu is a small industrial town. There's a big cement factory there. And they have a famous mountain, Mount Bukoza, which is famous for the night festival, which is December 3rd. And there is a mythical turtle up there. And also, Izane Nitobe's book, Musashi, I forget, it's about the samurai, and I apologize the name, but there's a whole mysticism and story about the temples in Chichibu and the samurais, and also the taiko. And so I end up in this small town. I am the only foreigner there. They've never had, I mean, they're foreigners that have gone as tourists, but I was with the Kyoiku Inkai, so the local municipal education board. I was not attached to a school. I was attached to the actual administrative offices. And there then I would go periodically and visit, do school visits and do some training of teachers and then some classes. And it was just a phenomenal experience. My wife today, Tracy, also came and followed on, and she worked in another town. And we really, not speaking Japanese and nobody around us spoke English, we really got immersed in the Japanese culture, and it just, we fell in love head over heels and stayed there for a couple years. And then we moved on. We actually biked around Asia and Eastern Europe. We spent about 16 months cycling and doing our backpacking with the savings we got from Japan. And then when we got back to California, we were going to go back in the business world. And there was quite a big advertising campaign to get people in the business world to go into education. And UCLA had a program. We applied. We both got grants. I actually got a grant because I was a male going into early childhood, and Tracy got a scholarship because she just is a very bright, amazing lady. So we got to UCLA and we did our master's and our teaching credential, and then worked at LA Unified. And at LA Unified, we met a superintendent that had been an international school educator. And he had kind of told us about it. And we were thinking, we love traveling in Japan, having done this bike trip across Asia. It just seemed like something we would like to further. And then we went to recruitment fair in San Francisco. And our first job was at the International School of Tanganyika. And as we went down the circuit, we always thought it'd be nice to go back to Japan. And we kept in touch with our friends in Japan. We actually did our honeymoon in Japan, went back to Chichibu for our honeymoon, which I don't think most people would choose Chichibu as a honeymoon destination. But if you've lived there and have a lot of close friends, it made a lot of sense. And we had just finished teaching in China at the Western Academy of Beijing, and we were recruiting. And Peter Cooper, the current head, the previous head and the current head while we were there, recruited us to come to Japan. So we were very excited. We were maybe a little naive because we thought we were coming back to the Japan that we knew, which was being immersed in Japanese culture, not being an expat, because we weren't expats. We were gaijins living in a Japanese city and working in a Japanese office. So there wasn't that kind of expat environment. And so we had to learn Japanese. We went to Tokyo University while we were at the JET program. They also had classes. And we really made an effort because it was a bit of a struggle not speaking Japanese and being in a small town. It was really actually quite difficult. So we were quite motivated. And then we got to ASIJ and it was, you know, it was complete expat land. And that was a bit of a culture shock. I think we didn't anticipate that. And we, for some reason, thought we would still have a lot of strong connections to the Japanese culture, which you can do. But I think it's much harder when you're in an environment in a school where it's English medium language. And of course, we had Japanese colleagues and our neighbors where we live. But we definitely had to go up to Chichibu on weekends to feel that old connection that we had so connected to. But don't get me wrong, we loved living in Tokyo, amazing city, and loved working at the school. We feel very fortunate to have had that experience. And both of our kids started school there. And so there are a lot of very rich memories. But I think when you come to Japan, not as an expat, in a situation maybe where you're working in a company and you're the only foreigner, it's a very different experience. I feel very fortunate to have had that experience because I feel I understand Japanese culture. Do you ever understand it? Who knows? You're better versed to know that, Nick, than anybody. But I feel my understanding of Japanese culture was very different than some of my colleagues at ASIJ.
I think you bring up a great point. And a question that I sort of want to bounce back to you is, as international school citizens, you know, we are, a lot of us are consistently migrating from one place to another. And I'm very interested in how schools will have programs for not only students, but for faculties in regards to how they want to sort of immerse themselves with the local culture, or sometimes, in fact, kind of how they avoid that. Right. I've been at definitely the schools where they want to be the expatriates, right? They don't want to deal with local schools. And obviously there's a variety of factors like, you know, the country's, you know, wealth as well, right? It's very different maybe to blend in you know, to local cultures when everyone's in poverty versus, you know, being in a more wealthier nation. But you have quite the background of, you know, being at more than a dozen, if I'm not mistaken, six or seven international.
I'm on my sixth one right now.
So six different countries. What would you say ASIJ did well, as well as what could ASIJ improve on when it comes to sort of immersing themselves to Japanese culture? Or just other
That's schools? A great question, Nick. Yeah, I think it's really challenging for schools to take on that responsibility to feel that they are going to get their staff to immerse with the local culture. I think you can do a lot of things. You can have events, you can highlight the culture and integrate it into the curriculum. And ASIJ had a long history with Japan. And I felt there were a lot of things. There was an immense amount of respect towards the Japanese culture. And there was a lot of sensitivity to the nuances that maybe expats didn't know, but I felt as a school, there was a lot of awareness of how to navigate the complexities of the Japanese culture. So in that way, I think they did a wonderful job. I really think it's challenging to ask a school to say, you bring in a bunch of people that are not from the country and expect or kind of facilitate for them to be more integrated. I think it's really about yourself and your own person. And that can be challenging when you're working all day. And at ASIJ, there was, you know, it was a very rigorous academic school, outstanding curriculum, outstanding teachers, very high expectations from the parents and the students. So your focus was really on teaching and learning. And, you know, after a long day, especially if you have two small children, there's just not as much time to then navigate the local culture, apart from maybe going to getting a yakitori or going to the izakaya or something like that. But you tend to do that anyway with your own you know, circle of friends. So I think that's a challenge. And in many schools that I've been to, I think it's so hard because so often the language can be really challenging. Japanese language is a challenging language to learn. When I was in the Czech Republic, it was the same. In Tanzania, the big issue that we faced was the economic divide, what we earned and had compared to the local Tanzanians was just day and night. So there was always that, you always were mindful of, you know, your role and not wanting to flaunt it, but just being of, you know, Caucasian background, immediately you represented a significant economic difference. And in China was the same thing. The language is quite challenging. It's a different environment, of course. So I think, you know, really, we here in Luxembourg, we taught in Switzerland and Luxembourg, and we both speak French and I speak German. There it's much easier because you have the language capacity. I think the language is a key player. Because you can, and in the Czech Republic, I didn't learn Czech. I spoke German, and you can't speak German there. But there was always this gap. And even though we had close Czech friends that spoke excellent English, you're just missing out on nuances. And I think at some point, you have to make a decision and understand that's a choice you've made to always be an outsider. And I know there are educators that marry within the culture and really kind of really dig in and really try to be part of the culture. But I'd say your general international school educator tends, that is a big ask and that's a big challenge. And I think schools always do the best as they can, providing free classes, there's orientation, there's often help. But at some point, it really depends on the individual and where your comfort level. And if you know you're only there for 4 years or 3 years, as many international educators like to move, then, you know, how much are you willing to invest? And I think you tend to invest more in the school culture and your school community than the outside community. I am not saying that's a fact. That's just my perception. It's not a general, it's a very, you know, my own view of that. But that's what I've discovered. And I think since I've been in Luxembourg, which is a French language and German language speaking country, and in Switzerland too, well, I was Swiss, so that made it easier. It's much easier. You know, I'm involved in things in the local community because there's no, they don't know that I'm working at an international organization. They just know I work and I speak French and we can have those conversations. And I know the nuances of the culture.
That's a great point about language being just such a key factor. And I do feel like, yeah, my experience is very limited to Central South America. But, you know, when I was in Honduras, I thought one big difference I saw culturally was that a lot of the teachers spoke Spanish. And that just made all the difference because, you know, I mean, I can't imagine like international school in China where, you know, 70% of the teachers are speaking Chinese. I think that would completely change the dynamics, you know, socially with parents and students. And you mentioned a great point of, you know, how when people know they're going to be somewhere 4 or 5 years, and not only that, but let's say you're at a very rigorous, you know, school in regards to workload, it's like, that's the last thing, right? And I myself feel very guilty about language. As we spoke off air a bit, I'm in my eighth year in South Korea, and I barely speak any Korean. And, you know, I'm wondering, and I think this would be an interesting question to you as an administrator, is when you are, you know, looking at people coming into schools, do administrators want people to stay 10, 20 years? Because that breed of international school teacher, I feel like is slowly disappearing from the market. Like when I was younger, I used to see a lot more teachers that were, you know, I've been in schools 15 years, 20 years. Is that by nature or is that happening more based on sort of a structural, I guess the way people are hiring?
So I would say I have hired people. I don't hire with people thinking they're going to stay here 10 or 20 years. My focus is really as what, you know, what skill set, dispositions and knowledge are they bringing to the role and how are they going to really support the community and what value added proposition they bring to the community. And then the other questions, of course, you have to sell your school and what it is that you bring. So I think the length is often not a conversation. But sometimes I know that in Luxembourg, we have teachers that have been here 20, 30 years. I remember at ASIJ, I had many colleagues that had been there decades. And there are huge advantages to that. But also, as you say, sometimes a bit of transition and new perspectives can be very rich. I don't know how much schools really explicitly think about that. I think it's really you want the right fit. The right person to support you and also want to make sure the environment and the culture and the school that you have is a good fit for that family or that candidate. What I would say is that definitely in Europe, I think it also depends the context you live in. In Tanzania, not many people stayed very long because it could be challenging. You know, there were very few people that were there beyond a decade, just because of the challenges with, you know, the economics, also just the dynamics of infrastructure and hospitalization and the medical services. All that became quickly, it was more like I'm doing 3-4 years. You know, I think at ASIJ, you can stay there because the infrastructure and the culture is something you can really settle into. Even if you don't speak Japanese, there is this such a rich community. And I think what often happens is people really engage with the school community, make some very meaningful, deep friendships, and they really see that as a good place for them to, you know, have their life. And if they have children and they like the kids like the school, and you think the school is really something that brings added value to your own children's education, then I think all those factors come into play. You know, so I think it's really hard, but I would say that schools like ASIJ, Western Academy is another example, definitely the school in Zurich and the school here in Luxembourg, there's much more longevity than maybe some schools in Central America or in, say, the Middle East or even in Africa, where it's nothing to do with the school, but maybe the challenges of living there, the geopolitical environment can make it sometimes more challenging. But you have teachers that will stay there a long time. So it's hard to say. I think as an administrator, one thing is we do, you know, try to be as upfront about the, you know, one of the things that we have a lot of teachers from Asia that like to come to Europe, and we talk to them about taxes. You know, suddenly you have to pay taxes. Guess what? We don't give you an apartment. You don't get a flight, you know? So those things come into play, and it's about quality of life. While in some schools, you get a flight, you get an apartment, you might be tax-free. So all those different variables come into play. And I think a lot of teachers that have children and are international school educators often will stay longer because they're invested in the school and their kids are getting an education, and that they feel it's a really good education. And we definitely felt that at ASIJ. Both our children got outstanding education, and that was definitely something that kept us there.
Well, speaking of education, I think it's a good segue into, you've been part of schools that have both AP as well as IB. So how, you know, and this comes up a lot, people ask me this question a lot, but I don't feel very well qualified to answer it because everything I know about IB are just from my buddies, you know, at St. Mary's and Seisen. So from your view, if you're a parent sending your kid to, you know, schools, what makes the IB attractive and what makes the AP attractive? And, you know, are there any common misconceptions people might have about either of the curriculums that you've dealt with?
I think sometimes people think if you have AP, you can't go to European universities. And I don't think that's true. So there's the feeling that, oh, if you're AP, you have to go to the US. And sometimes people think with the IB, you still need to do SATs, and maybe American universities are not as familiar. Both of those are not true, because both my children went to the University of Michigan, the other one went to McGill with IB, and there was never an issue. I think with the IB, it's, you know, AP, you get to pick. You don't have to do 6. You can do 1 or 2 or 3. So there's some flexibility. And I think for some learning styles, that's really something that can really be helpful, having that flexibility. The IB is quite prescriptive. You have to do the 6, you have to do the 3 hires and the 3 standards. There are permutations to that now, where the IB has different types of IBs. But I think both are, you know, I think it's the type of learner you are. What are the things that you're interested in? I think with the AP, you maybe have more flexibility in picking and choosing. While in the IB, you have to have group 1, group 2. So there's certain requirements that you have to fulfill with the IB. While the AP, you can have one individual AP. If you do math, it doesn't mean that you have to do a science. So I think it's really, what are you looking for? What is the learning style that really fits you? They're both excellent programs. I think, you know, one has to be careful to think, oh, with AP, I can only go to the US. I absolutely disagree with that. And we have that case here where we've had, I've been in AP schools and kids going to Europe and vice versa. So I think both are really excellent programs. I think it's more about the type of learner and what you're looking for as an experience, but I think both provide rigorous experiences.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too, but it's good here coming from you than from me. And similarly, would you agree with the assertion that I generally just tell people also just look at the schools, because what I think is really sort of has happened, especially in the last decade or so, is I think IB, and I think IB has a lot of wonderful points to it, has done a pretty good job with marketing. So There's a lot of sort of newer schools, and newer schools aren't necessarily, you know, not good. I work at a new school and I think we're great. But, you know, there's a lot of schools that, you know, have been around for 4 years, you know, 5 years, and they'll say we're IB, so we're better than a school that's AP. And usually my retort to that is, well, off the top of my head, Singapore American, they have both though, you know, Taipei American and American School in Japan are all pretty good schools without IB. So it's kind of like, you know.
I agree with you, Nick. I think a lot has to do with the teachers and the school and the kind of the mission and the learning principles and the values. Those are all really important. The IB is a vehicle, but really at the end of the day, it's about the teacher that's in the room. And, you know, what are they doing to engage you and motivate you and really get you excited about learning? And I think that's what's important. You know, the AP and IB are different curriculums, but I think it's really the teachers. And I think it's so important when you look at a school is also think about the teachers, the mission, what are the principles, what are the values that the school is, you know, engaging with. And I think those are so important. I think we were talking off air about the tier one, tier two, tier three. I think that's a bit of a dangerous thing to do. Just because you don't have a lot of money and you have a big flagship school doesn't mean you can have incredible teachers delivering really rigorous curriculum. So I'm always hesitant to classify schools. I think it's about what they stand for, how consistent and how do they, you know, what is their pedagogic compass and how well do they stick to it and how well do they make it consistent through the school? I think that's, and you know, is it about the students at the end of the day? That's what it should be about, the student learning.
That's great to hear. Again, coming from you, it has a bit more ethos. You run an international schools podcast, and you know, getting to, you know, my age, my mid-30s, you know, late 30s, a lot of my friends are now at the age where they have to make up their mind about sending their kids to international schools or not. With your international schools podcast, is that a topic that comes up very often about, you know, the parents' perspective of, you know, whether or not, you know, they should go to international school? If not, you know, how do they choose?
That's really interesting. Actually, no, we have not talked about parents. Most of our guests are, we have a kind of two types of guests. One are usually people that are working in international schools, school leaders, educators, that are doing something that's innovative, or there maybe they were international school educators and then they have a startup, or they start a new service, or they reinvent themselves. That's been a common theme. We also talk to authors and people working, psychologists, psychiatrists, you know, ed tech companies. So it's quite varied, but it's very much about teaching and learning more than the parent. But I love your idea. That would be interesting to have a podcast about the parents. We've had quite a few guests that were educators for decades and then decide to do something completely different or to start their own company. And that's been really exciting to see. Or educators that have a passion for something and they're implementing something in a school context that's very unique and very different. So that's kind of been the focus of the podcast that I do with a close friend, Dan Taylor, who actually runs a professional development organization called Apps Events. They're one of the official Google partners for professional development. And this is kind of a spin-off. We'd worked together and done a lot of things together. And we thought, wouldn't it be fun to, you know, all these people that we meet at conferences, wouldn't it be great to talk to them a bit like what you're doing?
Yeah, it's really cool. You and Dan Taylor, the International School Podcast. And I guess one thing that you did mention, though, that I think would maybe relate to sort of, you know, parents and prospective parents for international schools is obviously COVID has changed everything, right?
Yes.
That's needless to say. I don't think everyone already knows that. But obviously tech has become the real, you know, people I always cared about tech, but I think what COVID really showed us is how ill-prepared a lot of industries were, but especially education has been when it comes to, you know, providing robust and, you know, good education through whatever tech modality. So you being a tech expert, what do you think is going to change because of COVID? And is, you know, some of this remote learning, because as far as things look like for at least a year or two or five, we might have, you know, these periods where people go online suddenly for a week or two.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's a great question. And I think, you know, one thing for myself and many of colleagues, tech directors and digital learning coaches, the COVID had a silver lining. Finally, everybody listened to us, you know, in the sense that, people always knew that tech was important, but it wasn't a top priority, rightly so, because there are many other things, assessment, student portfolios, but, you know, we can go on. What it suddenly realizes is that this was make or break, and everybody had to pivot to a learning management system. Everybody had to get Zoom up or MS Teams or Google Meets or whatever flavor you were working with. And suddenly everybody's schools realized this is about making or breaking. This is about us even being remaining afloat. And a lot of schools, what's amazing actually is how many schools pivoted in a very short time. And I think, you know, there were, I think COVID was in two parts. There was the initial lockdown. And I think during that, we very likely didn't do the greatest job with online learning. And then the summer came about and schools that engaged in getting feedback from parents and students and their teachers recalibrated. And I think the second time around, things got much better and there was much more robust, good learning, rigorous learning taking place. What's interesting this morning, I actually was in a virtual meeting with a bunch of tech directors in Europe. And we're noticing a lot of people want to go back to what it was like before. There is kind of this longing to go back to normalcy or going back to something that we lost. I think the unfortunate reality is that's gone. That's never going to, we're not going back there. And now the question is, now that we've learned from these tools and remote learning, as you said, so rightly will continue, how can we leverage them in purposeful and authentic ways to continue using them even when we are back face to face or when we have to pivot? And I think generally teachers, I would say, have done a phenomenal job of saying, okay, I've got this big learning curve. I've never done a Google Meet. I've got 20 kids. I better work it out. And of course, there are a lot of digital coaches and tech integrators and IT directors in the background that have been helping and school administrators and other teachers, colleagues that have been sharing with each other. So I think what you have is a far more skilled group of educators and much more nimble with technology tools. Now the question is, how, as the dust settles, how do we now really leverage them in a meaningful, purposeful way and really see what could we maybe do differently? What can we keep doing? What might we want to stop doing? And what could we continue doing? And I think that's where a lot of conversations are occurring. There is no doubt what is happening outside in the real world. And I hate, I just have to, because so often school is a bit like a garden, you know, it's a curated garden. We can control what comes in and out to a certain level. But if you look where AI cohabitation and the erosion of privacy in the real world, you know, you think about all the different things that you watch on Netflix and in the paper, the Facebook scandal, I think there is a greater disconnect. And I think schools are still grappling how to catch up. Is it catching up? But what are the kind of the moral obligations to get people to be digital citizens and understand what does it mean to be manage my cybersecurity? What does it mean to have online relationships? And really navigating that in a school setting, I think, is where a lot of schools are starting to focus and have those conversations, because the world is changing at an accelerated pace. And I think so often we don't even realize, you know, we live by our phone, but we are maybe not that aware how much of our life is in the phone and how much the phone dictates our life.
Oh, yeah. It's crazy, as you're saying, the pace of technology developing. And do you do any VR type of stuff at part as part of your curriculum or at personal level?
Okay, so that's a good question. We have not done too much VR. The thing that we've done and I've worked with is the Google box. I don't know, it's the little cardboard box and you put your iPhone or Samsung. That's where we've been. There's more going on in VR. One of the issues is the entry point of the headsets. They're about $1,500, the best ones. And so I think VR, you're going to see more and more. I think it's also where the hardware becomes cheaper. It's a bit like laptops. You know, when laptops first came, you were spending $1,200 and now you can buy a Chromebook for $250. So I think as the hardware becomes more approachable for schools, because often schools are talking about large numbers. So if you have a class of 20, you know, you need at least 10 VR headsets. So it definitely is, there's traction. I think you're seeing more schools engage with it. Personally, I've only really worked with the Google Cardboard and some Google Glass previously, but definitely it's something that's on my radar and I think on a lot of people's radars. And there's some schools that have really engaged with it. I think it's really exciting. And I think this whole metaverse thing is going to be really interesting. You know, what does that look like for us in 10 years' time?
All right. So at the end here, I like to often ask my guests what they're up to in the coming years, coming decades. So I know with COVID, there's a lot of uncertainties, but what's coming up in your life for 2022?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, one thing that I'm starting to do some research on is senior citizens and digital literacy. Hmm. I have a lovely mother who's 86 and has an iPad, has an iPhone and a PC computer. Mm. And navigating this can be really challenging. And hats off to her. She's, you know, navigating them well. But for example, a great example is that photos can only be shared through WhatsApp and not email because she somehow worked out to get photos off WhatsApp and not her email. So it's something that I'm just kind of researching in the back of my head is, you know, what I'm finding out, there is not very much out there to support senior citizens with digital tools. And just that's kind of more a wondering that I have, you know, it's something that because I've been in the business of in the summers, I teach and coach school principals with the PTC. And I'm always interacting and teaching adults or facilitating workshops with adults. And I'm just curious more as a personal interest and wondering, what does that mean for this whole generation of baby boomers that are going into older age and how these digital devices have become non-negotiable? It's really hard to do any banking nowadays. Our local bank, actually, you can't go and see a teller. You have to make an appointment. Because they do everything online. So those kind of things. So that's, but in the short term, really, it's really, you know, as a school and where we are is just, I'll be honest, just trying to get, you know, what can we learn and leverage from our COVID experience in the pedagogic world and in the learning field? And what are some things that we can start doing differently? And that's something that, you know, we're all grappling with. And I think this whole idea of digital fluency and digital citizenship and kind of the moral compass that you have when you navigate and work with digital tools and digital environments, you know, what are we doing to make sure that these robots have ethics? But if you need to first teach students to have ethics as they start programming things, and those are kind of areas that I'm really interested in and I'm kind of engaging with in the different contexts that I have the privilege of working with, be it the school or with some of the professional organizations that I support.
Wow. So that sounds like some good long-term and short-term goals. The banking thing does scare me a bit because if you can only do it online, I think what's going to start happening is that the senior citizens don't learn how to do it on their own. They're just going to have their kids do it for them. And I imagine that would create a whole new myriad of issues when it comes to like
science. And I'm sure, you know, I know when I go home or my brother and sister, or my nieces and nephews or my children, we're always, when I go and visit my mom, there's always some tech issue or something. And, you know, it's great. I mean, I think the learning you know, systematically, what are we doing to support senior citizens when banks make decisions? Because banks often make decisions about, you know, how they can leverage efficiencies and or not. And it's just a wondering that I really want to explore further.
It's really interesting stuff. And, you know, hopefully next time we talk, maybe on this podcast, even COVID will be something of the past. But as you mentioned, a lot of things we learn through these tough times, tech-wise, will stick with us and, you know, make learning, you know, more accessible, you know, more efficient, more robust, you know, for everyone. And yeah, it was great talking to you, even online. I think it's been about 20 years.
Yeah, it's amazing. And Nick, hats off to you for doing your podcast. I actually had the pleasure of going into your archives and listening to them. And really, it's fantastic. Great conversations, great questions. And it's so exciting that you have the ASIJ alumni. You know, ASIJ remains a very special place in our hearts. And we're still in touch with many people from ASIJ. Mr. Hoover, Andrew Hoover is one. Mr. Lalaman, who was the librarian, and some other people. So it's really nice still to be connected with that community. And thank you for connecting and giving me the opportunity to participate.
No, thank you for being a guest. And again, I appreciate, you know, that we had that connection through ASIJ. It's definitely a school I also care about deeply. And Yeah, again, thank you so much for being part of this podcast today. I'm really grateful that our paths were able to cross once again after, I think it's been a long time. It's been at least over a decade. And I look forward to your podcast too. More to come at International School Podcasts. And again, the link will be in the doobly-doo.
Great. And absolutely, we'll have you on as a guest. Yeah, that's the deal. If you have me on there. Yeah, so I look forward. We'll reach out and think of something. Thank you so much, Nick. A real pleasure to connect. It's been 21 years just for your, which has been too long. And hopefully our paths will cross, not virtually, but physically. And if you're in Europe, do come and have a drink. Yeah?
Thank you so much. I look forward to us meeting again in person.